be honest to what the gods have given. Be honest to what the language asks of you and demands and deserves. And do that, and you begin to be true to everybody else too.
From the National Humanities Center, a conversation about poets and poetry, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future, with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Muriel Bradbrook of Cambridge University in England and Cleanth Brooks of Yale University are scholars in residence at the National Humanities Center. Professors Bradbrook and Brooks, noted scholars and critics of English and American literature, now discuss poets and poetry in the 20th century on both sides of the Atlantic. The conversation begins with Muriel Bradbrook.
I think that the poetry is read by relatively few people today, that it always has been read by relatively few, except for a period in the High Victorian Age, perhaps. But I think that there is so much increase in general reading, and particularly in output of books, that poetry appears to have declined much more than it has. What I think has declined is the long poem. I think nowadays nearly all poets write only short poems.
Well, I'd thoroughly agree. Granted, the availability of education, granted our high hopes for what a democracy will do with that education, a good many of us are prompted to say, why don't a great many more people read poetry?
Rather than the few who do.
That's right. But Miss Bradbrook is quite right. Professor Bradbrook is quite right. It never has been a vast number, or rarely, not often in our history.
Is it fair to say that what is being read today, and therefore what is being written today, still maintains a fairly high standard from your own personal standards, from your own personal points of view? Is poetry being done today?
Well, I would have to give a yes and no answer. I'm always surprised at how many people in the colleges are teaching poetry and reading poetry, at least in those terms. I'm also always surprised at how badly most young poets fare in getting their poems read.
Are they victims?
People don't buy poems of the sort.
Uh-huh. What causes that? What makes?
Well, I think we go back to Professor Bradbrook's comments. People don't buy enough books these days anyway. The availability of all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. But they don't. They'll get the novel or the nonfiction before they buy the book of poems.
Is poetry important today? Has it declined in importance?
Well, I think that it's extraordinarily important as the way of keeping the tools clean, as Ezra Pound said, keeping the language pure and honest and sensitive and able to cope with a rapidly changing situation. It was Shelley who said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators, and I believe that the whole state of society depends on people's ability to integrate thinking and feeling with a sensitive accuracy and honesty, and that this is what poetry gives us.
Is that true? Do poets really make that much of a difference, or was Shelley simply talking to other poets and consoling himself? And
Well, as you know, Wayne, I've been talking a good deal lately about Seamus Heaney, who I think is the best poet writing in English at the moment. I think in the last 2 years he has suddenly come to the fore, and this is a horrifyingly apt moment to speak about violence in Ulster, but I think that Seamus's sensitive attempt to consider the roots of violence and to put forward integrative statements is very, very apropos to...
Do you think that poets make a difference politically, socially in the world? Professor Brooks, you were part, you are part of a group of writers and critics and poets who made a conscious effort to make a difference in American life, the agrarians.
Well, you're quite right. They did make a conscious effort to do it, not through their poetry primarily, though that was tightly tied to their prose works and their propaganda for the causes they thought were proper. Mm-hmm. I must say that if you use them as a measuring stick, it would seem to indicate the poets don't make much difference. It's interesting, however, that in another, you could argue the question the other way. For example, here were people in 1930 who wrote a book that everybody laughed at, Defense of Agrarianism. If they had called themselves ecologists, which is what they were, part of what they were saying, they would now be hailed as true prophets 50 years later, in which people are getting worried about too much industrialization.
Why didn't that occur then, as you look at it in retrospect?
Well, the human being is a cantankerous animal, and oftentimes it takes a long time for him to ideas to seep through, for impress to be made. It wasn't the good poet. I'm sure Professor Bradbrook would agree with this. The good poet is not the person who normally initiates fads or rides fads. He's always trying for deeper, more universal truths. And those are the very truths that sometimes it takes the population as a whole.
So in that regard, it's unfair to say that a poet should necessarily make a political or a social difference.
Yes, in fact, one could quote a very good American poet on that subject. When people were talking to old Robert Frost about poetry ought to being engaged poetry and making things happen, Frost agreed cheerfully that poetry made things happen, but he indicated it often made things happen a long time later. The effect was not necessarily immediate.
Mm-hmm. Professor Bradbrook, how does a poet work with an idea so that it will have a long-term effect? You mentioned Seamus Heaney. Is this an example? Is he an example of what you, of that idea?
He does not work with ideas, God forbid. He works with language. He works so that he can bring up the inarticulate to the level of being articulate. He deals with a highly emotional situation in language that can face thinking and feeling, and that is why, as Professor Brooks has said, it takes a long time for the poetry to impinge on society. Wordsworth had to create the taste by which he was appreciated. So does every poet who is worth considering. And Shelley said the unacknowledged legislators. Heaney wrote a poem called The Unacknowledged Legislator's Dream, which was a dream of being arrested. I think that it is a very long, slow process of permeation. Of course, you can have a momentary reaction in a crisis. You might call the Marseillaise poetry. I don't know what it is. It's a jolly good marching song anyway. And the Americans also have their marching songs. And there were poems in the Civil War that I presume had a great influence. But the kind of political poetry that Heaney writes is not like that. It is diffusing violence. It is speaking for the impossibility of apportioning guilt and blame. It is the poetry of a humble man, stricken by what he sees, but determined to try to understand it with his whole self, not just with his mind, not just as an idea. Anybody can write with ideas, you know. They wouldn't be poets if they were just writing with ideas.
I think it's so important, the point you made about the poet helping us articulate those things which remain dumb inside of us and we can't get a hold of, we can't articulate. Eliseo Vivas, who I think is one of our best theoreticians, has made the point again and again in his book on creation that the poet renders an inestimable service to the civilization by letting us know what it is that is troubling our insides. He'll take a fairly coarse, easy one. The Grecian Trojan horse. People talk about Trojan horses all the time. We've turned it into a cliche. But you had to have the account of something like the Trojan horse for people to get their grasp on this kind of thing, the peril that comes inside, the thing that takes you in, the ways to penetrate the best defenses, and so on. Mm-hmm. That's a crude example, but surely this is very true. The poet does articulate our feelings, and if we are left inarticulate, we fume and simmer and boil and stammer, but we don't ourselves know what's wrong with us.
Well, let's assume the givens that you have you've discussed so far, that poetry is being written, that it is genuine poetry, it's good poetry, although the audience may have declined and there are other factors, television and films, to distract people from reading poetry. They don't read it in such great numbers as they used to. What are the major preoccupations and themes of poets in the 20th century on both sides of the Atlantic?
I would say that there are a sequence of poets, beginning perhaps with Philip Larkin, who is a librarian at the University of Hull, that's how he earns his living, and has written regular poetry for about 30 years. My friend Kathleen Rain, who has written poetry for longer than that, and Seamus Heaney, whom I've mentioned, and R.S. Thomas, what these poets have in common is this. They are border poets. They have lived on the border between two countries. Seamus between Ulster and the Republic, Kathleen Rain between England and Scotland, the Welsh poets on the Welsh borders, and this has given them a sense of the society in which we live. Without knowing it, we are all living in border countries now, because the common relation of the whole world means that wherever we are, even if we are right in the middle of the United States on the Mississippi, we are still in a border country. And certainly at home in England, everywhere, you feel that you are in a border country.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, Putting Ideas into Circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Muriel Bradbrook of Cambridge University in England and Cleanth Brooks of Yale University are both scholars in residence at the National Humanities Center. Professors Brooks and Bradbrook are discussing contemporary British and American poets and poetry. The conversation resumes now with Muriel Bradbrook's observations about similarities that exist among English poets.
The second thing which these people have in common is that they all have a deep sense of history, and that they are attempting to explore the present by going back to an archaic past. The age of the old invasions of the islands. A third point they have in common is that they are all engaged with familial relationships, ordinary relations often of parents and children, their own families, as well as husbands and wives, and that they write in a thoroughly conventional way. Heaney, for instance, is almost disgracefully fond of his parents. He presents nothing at all for a psychoanalyst to get hold of. He's also monogamous, and he has written a number of poems to his wife, one based on Robert Lowell's Skunk Hour, comparing her with a skunk. It must be the first time that a love poem has ever compared the lady to a skunk, and it's a very beautiful poem. The family enables these people to deal with much larger, more difficult social relationships in an integrated way, but they are not in the direct sense political poets. They're not Marxists or rightists or leftists, or because they're dealing with these matters at a deeper level.
A poet is someone who can generalize his own experience or her own experience. Is it as simple as that?
Well, it's as simple as that, and it's also as complicated as that, because to do that requires really a great mastery of arts which we don't ordinarily associate with the learned man of our day, the social engineer. The hardcore scientist is living in much time in a very abstract, highly theoretical world, which is fine. We need them and want them. But we need a man on the border, also to use Professor Bradbrook's phrase, between the world of sensation, of feeling, and so on, and the world of ideas, and able to bring them together.
What's going on in American poetry, Professor
Well,
Brooks?
I would like to, again, follow where Professor Bradbrook has put the way, so stated the way so well. We have something like the border situation, which he describes so well in Britain. I mean, literally have it. If you look at the poets, and fiction writers, too, for that matter, the ones who have been particularly interesting in the United States in the last two or three generations have been the Southerners, who are border in the sense that they represent a kind of rather distinct subculture, but who recognize themselves as also American. And so you have a little tug and tension there. The Jewish writer, something of the same thing, a special enclave, a special society, culture, but inside of a larger culture, a powerful culture. The black poet, the black writer, and if one uses this carefully and with some sensitivity, the women, particularly those who have felt themselves, is moving into a world no longer simply dominated by men in certain ways.
Do poets write for themselves, or do they write for an audience?
Well, in the old days, the poet would say he wrote for the muse. And I'm perfectly willing to take that mythology as still useful, because when you write for the muse, you're writing for others, but something other than yourself, but you're writing also to try to satisfy your own deepest artistic instincts. If you simply try to write for others and don't give a hoot about the art, you're simply back to the ad man or the public relations man, and that doesn't give you poetry. If you're writing, on the other hand, just to suit yourself without any concern for anything further, the muse or the public either, you get something goonishly private. And I'm afraid we get a good deal of that in this country.
Who should the poet consider first, himself or his audience? Does his own inner...
I think he should consider his art first. Well, I'm using art in a very exalted sense, the craft. Be honest to to what the gods have given. Be honest to what the language asks of you and demands and deserves. And do that, and you begin to be true to everybody else too.
Do poets feel obligations? Do they feel responsibilities in their writing? What are their motives? What moves them to take up their pens?
Dylan Thomas said he wrote in love of man and in praise of God. I agree entirely with Professor Brooks that he writes not for an audience and not for himself. He writes for the language, for the causes that he serves, for the muse, and for God, perhaps, if he believes in God. Mm-hmm. But certainly not either just for himself, which would not produce poetry, and certainly not just for his audience, which, as Professor Brooks said, would produce the ad man.
Professor Bradbrook, you are professional critics. You make your living doing literature, I suppose you could say. How is it that a critic can go public?
Well, I think that at a lesser level and a less important level, the critic's situation mirrors that of the poet. We have people who do fairly easy popularized reviews, which are often self-exploiting or playing up to the trends or giving the public what they want, feeding them what they think they will like. And we have more austere critics who are really trying to find, locate, exalt the better minds, the better poets who need to be introduced. You have both sides. I think that one of the problems of poetry today is what is coming up in one of the very recent schools, which argues, I think very foolishly, that the critic is just as much of a creative artist as the poet himself. Therefore, it doesn't really matter whether he's sticking to the text of the poem that he's supposed to be talking about or not. Let him make up his own. Let him simply be entertaining. I'm oversimplifying the thing, but we have something of that sort. I think that's very foolish. I think the critic's job is a terribly important one, but I think it's a humble job. I don't think he should ever try to replace the poem itself with his own attempt to help people read the poem.
Professor Bradbrook, how would you describe the relationship between the poet and the critic?
Well, the best critics have been poets, according to Matthew Arnold and T.S. Eliot, and the poets Philip Sidney, Shelley, Arnold himself, Eliot, Coleridge have been among our very best critics, so that the best relationship is perhaps an identification between the two.
So you're making a case for the humanist as a citizen of the world and not simply an occupant of a very small piece of ground that he cultivates exclusively for himself.
Well, I don't think the critic ought to cultivate it just for himself. We're back again, the problem, does the poet write merely for himself, for his own gratification? Mm-hmm. I think that the critic has a public duty, but he must not vulgarize it. He must not play to run up the sales of the bestsellers simply because they're bestsellers.
And what is that duty? What is his responsibility?
Well, again, in his own very different way, special way, humble way, to help keep the language purified, to point out values, where people need help in reading, to help them see what is truly good, truly worth mastering, appropriating, and up to a point to do what old cantankerous Ezra Pound said, keep down vermin. Point out what is silly or pornographic or sentimental and so on. There is a sense in which the poet's job is always a high and lonely one, but it's not an arrogant one, far from that.
Professor Brooks, Professor Bradbrook, you've discussed the themes of poets and poetry in the 20th century. You've talked about the relationship between the poet and the critic, the poet and his or her public. What do you see on the horizon?
Professor Brooks has mentioned the critics who now treat criticism as a kind of private game. The art of criticism just taking off from the poem, which is a sort of launching pad from which the critic spirals away into space, making his own poems. I have heard it proposed in reading a poem by Wallace Stevens that one word wasn't as agreeable to the critic as another word, so he just substituted his own reading. Seems to me a game which is very fashionable at the moment, but which will not survive. And I hope that we shall keep on the double path which I've seen. I remember when I was a young woman meeting Helen Derbyshire, the editor of Wordsworth, and she regarded herself as a steward of great riches. It was her business to hand on this possession as the inheritor of a great old beautiful house might hand it on to tend it, not to alter it in any way, just to preserve it. That's a noble position, but I think one has to add what Professor Brooks has said about keeping the tools of the language clean and pure and sharp. And this is a piece of work that requires much pains, much thought. So we have to go back, particularly for the poets of the past, and try to reconstitute their age. I've spent upwards of half a century now trying to reconstitute the background for Shakespeare's plays, because I think that we do understand them better if we understood the quite different world in which he lived. This does not mean that we have to live in that world, or that what we bring to the art, what helps to keep it a classic, is not part of it as well, that it acquires new meanings from being transmitted through many generations, and we have to transmit it in the form appropriate to our age, to our descendants.
I know that we still have in the English-speaking world some very able poets. I think we have some very sound critics and some very fine scholars who had worked doing the sort of thing that Professor Bradbrook has done so admirably through a lifetime. I take heart from the fact that one of my friends, I don't mind saying that about him here on this occasion, Robert Penn Warren, now in his 76 years, writing, I think, some of the best poetry he's ever written in his life. He's been writing a lifetime. Still vigorous, his poetry, some of it the best he's ever written, quite recent, who is himself a good critic, a reasonable and able critic, not just promoting himself. How many more people of that breed we have, I don't know. We have a whole generation of younger poets knocking at the gate. How many will go on to greatness, we don't know. But I would say the situation is not necessarily pessimistic, far from it.
Professor Bradbrook and Professor Brooks, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me for the Center's radio program, Soundings. This week, two distinguished critics and historians of literature, Muriel Bradbrook and Cleanth Brooks, will provide explanations and insights about English and American poetry in the 20th century. Please join me this week for Soundings.